Chapter 16, Perversion Charged.
The second week of the trial opened on Monday, August 4th. It was then that the state introduced its most important witness, James Conley, a Negro sweeper in the factory and the only witness who connected Frank directly with the crime. The public waited anxiously for the Negro to take the stand, and when it was announced that he would be questioned on this day, a crowd larger than any previous one besieged the courthouse. The police had instituted the plan of making spectators get in line to await the opening of the doors, and on Monday, two lines of men in single file extended around the building on each side. It began to form shortly after daylight, and by 8:30 a.m. had swelled to several hundred. The majority of the waiters were disappointed, however, owing to the limited seating capacity of the courtroom. Before court opened, Judge L. S. Roan announced from the bench that all the women present would have to leave. This was the first direct intimation of the sensational charges of perversion and misconduct among the factory girls which were introduced. At 9 o'clock, James Conley took the stand. He was the same Conley who had swept the floors of the pencil factory in the past, the same Conley who had been hailed into police court on disorderly conduct charges, the same Conley, except that he was sleeker when he entered the jail, and that he had been shaved and bathed and dressed to be presentable before the jury. With little questioning by Solicitor Dorsey, he told glibly his story of carrying the body of the dead girl to the basement at the direction of Superintendent Frank. Then he went further. He made the sensational assertion that once he had caught Frank in a compromising attitude with a woman in his office at the factory, and that on previous Saturday afternoons and holidays he had watched at the front door of the building while Frank kept clandestine appointments with women on the second floor. On Friday afternoon, the witness declared, Frank had instructed him to return to the factory Saturday morning. "What time did he say for you to come?" asked Solicitor Dorsey. "At 8:30, replied the black. "Who got there first Saturday morning?" "We met at the door, and I followed him in." "What conversation did you have?" "After we got in on Saturday morning, Mr. Frank said that I was a little early. I told him it was the time he'd said for me to come. He said I was a little too early for what he wanted. He said he wanted me to watch for him like I had other Saturdays." "What had you done other Saturdays?" "I had watched for him while he was upstairs talking with young ladies." "What did you do?" "I would watch at the door and let him know." "How often had you done this?" "Several times. I don't know how many." "Was Frank up there alone on those Saturdays?" "No. Sometimes there'd be two young ladies, and sometimes other men from the factory."
"Was Mr. Frank ever alone there?"
"Yes, sir. Last Thanksgiving Day."
"Who came then?"
"A tall, heavy-built woman."
"What did you do then?"
"I stayed just like I did on April 26th and watched at the door."
"What had Mr. Frank told you to do on Thanksgiving Day?"
"I did like he told me and locked the door when he stomped on the floor after the lady had come in."
"That was Thanksgiving Day, 1912?
"Yes, sir."
"Now, tell what happened on April 26th.
"We both went inside. He told me I was a little early. I said, no, sir. That was the time he told me to come. He said I was a little early for what he told me to do. He told me he wanted me to watch. I told him I had to go to the Capital City Laundry and asked him what time he wanted me to come back. He told me I could go from the Capital City Laundry to Nelson and Forsyth Streets and watch there till he come back from Montag's."
Conley continued his narration of the events on the morning of April 26. He told of going to the Capital City Laundry and of meeting Frank at Nelson and Forsyth Streets. "What happened when he returned to the factory?" he was asked by Dorsey.
"We went in, and Mr. Frank told me about the lock on the front door. 'If you turn this knob this way, nobody can get in,' he said. Then Mr. Frank told me to come over and said, 'Set on that box.'
He said there'd be a young lady up here pretty soon. We'd want to chat a while, Mr. Frank said. When I stamp, that's her. And when I whistle, you come up and say you want to borrow some money, and that will give her a chance to get out.
Did he say anything else before he went upstairs? Asked the solicitor.
Yes, sir, said the witness. He hit my chest right here. The negro pointed to a place near his right shoulder, and he said, Now, boy, don't let Mr. Dolly see you.
Answering questions put by the solicitor, Conley told of seeing various people come and go while he lurked in the hallway. At about 12 o'clock, the negro said he saw Lemmy Quinn, Mary Fagan, and Monteen Stover enter the building in the order named. The former and latter came out, but Mary never came down, he said.
After she went up, the witness said, I heard her footsteps going toward the office, and then steps toward the metal room. The next thing I heard was her screaming.
Then what did you hear? Persisted the state's prosecutor.
I didn't hear any more, answered the negro.
Who was the next person you saw go upstairs?
The next one I saw go up was Miss Monteen Stover.
How was she dressed?
She was wearing tennis shoes and a red coat.
Have you seen Miss Stover since then?
Yes, sir, once.
How long did she stay upstairs?
She stayed a pretty good while. Not so very long, either.
Then what?
She came back down.
What happened then?
Then I heard tiptoes coming from the metal department.
Where did they go?
I don't know, sir.
What next?
Next I heard tiptoes running back toward the metal department.
Then what?
Then I sat back on the box and kind of went to sleep.
All right, what next?
Next I heard Mr. Frank stomping over my head. I waked up the first time he stomped. Then I heard him stomp two more times. He stomped 3 times altogether.
Then what did you do?
I got up and locked the door like Mr. Frank told me to do. Then I sat back down on the box.
How long did you sit there?
A little while.
All right. Then what happened?
I heard Mr. Frank whistle.
How long after the stomping was it before you heard him whistle?
Just a few minutes.
Well, what did you do when you heard Frank whistle?
I went upstairs like he told me to do when he whistled. Mr. Frank was standing at the head of the stairs, shivering. He was rubbing his hands together and acting funny.
Show the jury how he was acting. The negro stood up, made his legs tremble, rubbed his hands together, rubbed his right hand backward and forward from the back of his head to the face, and reverse.
What did Frank have? He held a little cord in his hand.
Did you look at his eyes?
Yes, sir.
How did they look?
His eyes was large. They looked funny and wild.
Did you notice his face?
Yes, sir. It was red, very red.
Solicitor Dorsey produced the cord, which had been taken from around the neck of the corpse of the body of Mary Fagan.
Is that the kind of cord he had in his hand? He asked.
Yes, sir, just like that, answered the negro.
Did Frank say anything to you?
Yes, sir. He asked me if I saw the little girl pass along up there. I told him yes, I saw two, but one went out, but that I didn't see the other one come out.
Conley testified that Frank told him that he had gone back to the metal room, and that Mary Fagan had resisted advances that he had made. Frank said that there had been a struggle in which the girl had fallen and hurt herself. Conley declared that Frank had remarked, You know, Jim, that I am not like other men, referring to a previous happening when the negro had interrupted the young superintendent in peculiar relations with another girl.
He told me to go back to the metal room, said the negro. He said, We got to get her out. Hurry up now, and there'll be some money in it for you.
Did you find the girl?
Yes, sir. She was lying flat on her back, with a rope around her neck. There was a piece of cloth tied around her neck, too.
The direct examination of Conley was completed in less than 2 hours.
His cross-examination was probably the most remarkable feature of the trial. For 3 days and a half, Luther Z. Rosser fired questions at the Negro in an attempt to trip him up on some point in his testimony, but never once did the black lose his head. He was taken over and over his story, and he repeated it without a variation. Traps were laid by the shrewd Rosser, but the Negro avoided them. The examination resolved itself into a physical endurance contest. At one time, Attorney Arnold took the floor to address a question to the witness. The move was taken by Dorsey to mean that the two attorneys for the defense intended to question the Negro in relays and wear him out. He interposed an objection, and Judge Roan ordered that Attorney Rosser would have to continue the questioning. The testimony of Conley was taken down by 4 stenographers in half-hour relays. As soon as one had completed his take, he would hurry to a typewriter and transcribe his notes. By this means, the defense lawyers were supplied with copies of the official testimony of Conley 2 hours after it had been entered in the record. They repeatedly asked him questions put previously, and his answers were the same, almost verbatim. Attorney Rosser asked him about occasions on which he had previously watched while Frank entertained women friends in his office. He went into the minutest details. The Negro never hesitated in answering, although he frequently replied, "I disremember." "Tell us about the first time you watched. You said it was in July 1912. Who was there that day?" "C.B. Dalton, and a woman who worked on the first floor, and another woman named Daisy Hopkins, who once worked at the factory," the Negro replied. "About 3 or 3:30 in the afternoon?" "What were you doing?" asked the attorney. "I was sweeping when they come in, but Mr. Frank called me to his office and asked if I wanted to make a piece of money, and then he told me to watch the door for him. I went down and watched, and pretty soon that young lady went out, and she came back with a man, Mr. Dalton. Then they went upstairs, and I heard them walk into Mr. Frank's office. They stayed about 10 or 15 minutes, and then the young lady and Mr. Dalton come out, and the young lady says, 'All right, James,' and then I took 'em back and opened the trap door, and then they went down the ladder to the basement."
"Who told you to open that door, Jim? Did she tell you?"
"No, sir. Mr. Frank had told me when he was talking with me."
The witness declared that he had no idea of the length of time the couple stayed in the basement, but said that he waited near the trapdoor and opened it for them to come up. In answer to questions, he then declared that Dalton went on out and the girl went upstairs, and after waiting at the head of the stairs for several minutes, went into the office. A little later, she and Miss Hopkins came down, and it was considerably later that Frank left the office, he said. Mr. Dalton, he said, gave him a quarter, and Mr. Frank gave him another as he was leaving. The witness said that the girls left about 4:30 p.m. The witness was told by the cross-examiner to narrate the events of the next visit of women to the factory, which Conley said was on a Saturday about 2 weeks later. At that time, Conley declared that Frank came up to him early in the morning and told him that he wanted to put him wise for the afternoon. Frank returned to the office about 2:15 that afternoon, he said, and shortly after he went into the office, Mr. Holloway left. Some time later, the Negro declared, Miss Daisy Hopkins came in, and he followed her up the steps and saw her go into the office. Frank snapped his fingers at him, he declared, and bowed his head. Then he went down and watched at the front door, and Frank gave him 50 cents after the girl had left. "Now tell about the next time, Thanksgiving," Mr. Rosser said to the Negro.
"No, sir, it was not Thanksgiving," said the Negro. "It was before Thanksgiving, early in the winter."
"When was it?"
"About the middle of August."
"Oh, yes," said Mr. Rosser. "It was pretty cold that day, wasn't it?"
The Negro saw the trap and neatly dodged it. "No, sir, 'twas not cold."
"Well, it was winter. It was sort of cold." No, I can't say it was cold, Conley answered. Well, that morning, he continued, Mr. Frank told me he wanted to put me wise again for that afternoon.
Oh, yes, interrupted Rosser. He used that same word every time, didn't he? The negro said that he did that time and the other time, but was not sure he used it after every time he spoke of the matter. What was this woman's hair like? Asked Attorney Rosser. After looking around the courtroom, the negro replied, It was like Mr. Hooper's.
You seem to know Mr. Hooper well. How is that?
Well, he talked to me once or twice.
It is gray like Hooper's?
If that is gray, it was.
What sort of clothes did she wear?
She had on a green suit.
Now let's take Daisy Hopkins, said Attorney Rosser. What did she wear?
First time she came, she wore a black skirt and a white shirtwaist.
What did she wear the second time?
Same thing.
Did you ever speak to her around the factory?
No, sir, she didn't know me.
You've been there for 2 years. Do you mean to tell me that everybody around there don't know Jim Conley?
Lots of 'em don't know me.
Who are some of them?
I don't know, but there's lots of them.
Attorney Rosser then questioned Conley about last Thanksgiving Day, when he said he again acted as lookout for Frank. Conley said that he had waited near the door until the woman came. He said he got to the factory about 8 or 8:30 a.m., and that she entered about half an hour later.
Did you know her?
No, sir. I never saw her since. I saw her in Mr. Frank's office about 3 days before that.
Was it the same week?
I don't know. It was sometime near Thanksgiving, though.
What time was that?
About 8 o'clock in the evening.
What were you doing there so late?
I was stacking some boxes upstairs.
How was she dressed?
I think she had on black clothes. I don't remember exactly.
How was her face?
Oh, she was good-looking.
Now, on this Thanksgiving morning, you closed the door after her?
Yes, sir.
And you say when Mr. Frank stamped his foot, you locked the door after her?
Yes, sir. When Mr. Frank stamped, I closed the door.
Was there any signal? How many times was he to stamp?
Twice.
It wasn't three, was it?
No, sir, it was twice. And then I was to kick the door of the elevator twice.
What did you do after that?
I sat on the box.
How long?
About an hour and a half, it seemed to me.
And then she came down?
No, Mr. Frank come down. He said, Is everything all right? And then he opened the door and looked up and down the street, and then called to her. All right. Then she come down, and they walked to the door, and as they passed me, the woman looked at me and said, Is that the nigger? And Mr. Frank said, Yes, that is the best nigger I ever saw.
Did she say that to you? Queried Attorney Rosser.
No, replied the black. She was talking to Mr. Frank.
Conley was questioned about every assertion he had made in his affidavits to the police.
Time and time again, he admitted that he had lied when questioned by the detectives.
I told a million lies, I guess, he said.
The end of the first day's grilling, the state was jubilant. Conley was telling the truth at last, they believed. They were confident that the defense would never break him down.
It's a bear fight, and I am betting on our bear, was the comment of Frank A. Hooper.
Later, several days after Conley had been grilled, Rosser remarked, That's a smart nigger. He's the smartest one I ever tackled. But he's the greatest liar on earth. The most bitter legal battle of the whole case occurred on the afternoon of Tuesday, August 5th, when the defense attorneys unexpectedly moved that all the testimony of Conley pertaining to watching for Frank on previous days and the statements of the negro attacking his character be stricken from the record. The motion was made immediately after the midday adjournment. Attorney Arnold arose and asked that the jury be sent out. After the talesman had marched from the room, he announced to the court that he wanted this testimony expunged from the transcript on the grounds that it was irrelevant, immaterial, incompetent, and inadmissible. "We move first," he said, "to exclude from the record all the testimony of Conley relative to watching for the defendant, and we withdraw our cross-examination on that subject. Second, Mr. Arnold moved that a portion of the Negro's testimony attacking Frank's character, which was brought out through questions propounded by the solicitor, be ruled out. Mr. Arnold concluded the argument by saying, "Before anything else is done, we move to exclude this from the record." Judge Roan spoke up. "As I understand it, Mr. Arnold, what you want to withdraw is testimony about watching on other occasions." Attorney Hooper took the floor, saying, "To allow this motion would be to trifle with the court. We purpose to bring out witnesses to sustain Conley. When they did not object at the time this evidence was introduced, I believe they lost any ground that they had for an objection. If their objection had been entered at the time of the introduction of this testimony, I should say that the objection was well taken, but I do not think that they have a right, after letting it go on into the records without protest, now to move for its total exclusion." Frank dropped his head, and his mother put her arm around his neck and patted him on the shoulder and whispered in his ear. He smiled faintly and looked around. Solicitor Dorsey addressed the court. "I submit, Your Honor," said he, "as an original proposal, this evidence is admissible. They have waited too late to enter their objection." Mr. Rosser interrupted. "We move to rule it out because it is immaterial," said he, addressing both the court and the solicitor. "If you've got any authority to back up your objection," retorted the solicitor, "trot it out." "I never trot out anything in court," replied Mr. Rosser. "I've got too much respect for the court." "Well, gallop it out, lope it out," said the solicitor. "It doesn't make any difference, just so you produce it." "You wouldn't understand it if we did," snapped Mr. Rosser. Solicitor Dorsey proceeded, ignoring the last remark. "Your Honor, just as a matter of fairness, I submit that it is not right to let this gentleman give this witness a most severe grueling for 2 days, go into his testimony by cross-examination, and then come along and ask that certain portions of it be ruled out. They would stop us now from corroborating the testimony of this witness as to Frank's conduct. To grant their motion would be to stop us from introducing our corroborative evidence." The solicitor announced that he had other witnesses waiting to corroborate Conley. "Is it fair, Your Honor, after 1, 2, 3, 4 able counsel have sat here and let this evidence get into the record, after they have cross-examined the witness for 2 days, and then wake up to the conclusion that it should be expunged from the record? Is that a fair proposition? The state's case will have been done a great damage," continued the solicitor, "if now, after the defense has derived all the benefit it possibly can expect from cross-examination, these facts are cut out, and we are not given an opportunity to put witnesses on the stand to show that this man Jim Conley has spoken the truth. Now, the able counsel sees the terrific force of these transactions, and they would stop us from corroborating them. I appeal to you, in the name of fairness and justice, to let counsel now see that objections, if they are to be entertained, must be timely. Why, Your Honor, they have gone into even the workings of the National Pencil Factory and showed this man Conley's relations with 6 different men, and they have done so very properly, for it shows his connection with this defendant, and is a part of the history of the crime. I will tell Your Honor right now that we have witnesses to sustain this man. Any piece of evidence, any transaction, anything of his past conduct to show his intent and purpose when he got this girl up there is admissible, and it is largely by this that we are showing what this man did to poor little Mary Fagan.
Anything to show his motive must be admissible. As to the distinct relevancy of this testimony, I cite as an instance the testimony of Dr. Hurt. This testimony, which they would rule out, goes right to the point, and it will be corroborated. It goes largely to show who killed the girl. I beg of you to think twice before you rule out these powerful circumstances. Solicitor Dorsey challenged the defense to produce any decision written within the past 5 years contrary to this principle. The courts are slow, said Mr. Dorsey, too slow to progress. But this one rule the courts have now taken up. The importance of this testimony will be more manifest before we get further in this case. During Solicitor Dorsey's arraignment of Frank, Mrs. Frank, wife of the accused, arose from her seat and left the room. She went into an anteroom and remained several minutes. When she returned to the court, there were fresh tears in her eyes. She resumed her seat at her husband's side. "There's no use making stump speeches here," said Mr. Arnold. "There's no use waxing so eloquent. I could do it, I guess. But I don't want to make my jury argument while it's so hot, unless I have to." Mr. Arnold termed the objectionable evidence miserable, rotten stuff, and went on to say that the defendant suffered outrageously by its admission into the records. "The state admits that it is illegal evidence," said he. "The only ground that they want it retained on is that we didn't make timely objection. In a criminal case, you never can try a man for but one crime. That's the old Anglo-Saxon way. In France and in Italy and in Germany, when a prisoner comes into court, he comes prepared to answer for his whole life. But it's not that way here. We only try a man for one crime." "I sympathize with the little girl's parents as much as anybody. But I say it is just as much murder to attempt to convict this defendant by the introduction of illegal and irrelevant evidence. This miserable wretch on the stand," pointing to Conley, "has told a glib parrot-like tale. He was schooled in it for 2 months, and I feel sorry for anybody that will believe him. He has introduced another capital crime into this case. Not that I believe a white man would believe a word he said, but his testimony has brought it in. A case of murder is distinctly marked case. And as I understand it, the state does not contend even that this is a premeditated case. The state has put this man on the stand, and they want to bolster up his outrageous tale with lots of irrelevant matter."
Attorney Arnold attacked the Supreme Court decision cited by Solicitor Dorsey, contending that the decision was written in a case involving illegal sale of cocaine, and not in a murder case. "Murder," he said, "is an entirely different matter, and is more serious than the selling of cocaine. If this evidence is admitted, we would have to stop investigating the murder and take up the investigation of two other cases, and the cases he mentioned are not parallel with this. With this evidence before the jury, there is a likelihood of that body convicting this defendant on general principles. I am coming under a general rule when I say this ought to be ruled out. Your Honor, how much confusion would be in the jury's mind? How much the issue would be clouded?" continued Mr. Arnold. "How unfair to this defendant, in a day or two, without notice, to require him to answer such charges as these. It would necessitate our going back over all these days this villain has mentioned. We would have to call in every employee of the factory, and goodness knows how many other witnesses. If they can put such evidence as this in, we certainly can rebut it. This is illegal testimony, and they have done us an incalculable injury to let this suspicion get into the minds of the jury." Judge Roan interrupted Mr. Arnold. "Everything relating to the watching on the particular day, April 26th, is relevant. Everything relating to that particular transaction is a part of this case," said Mr. Arnold. We are not even objecting to what this witness says happened at the factory or what was told him on the Friday before.
Judge Roan announced his ruling as follows. There's no doubt in my mind that this evidence was inadmissible as an original proposition, and I will rule out all except as to the watching on that particular day. Attorney Hooper requested the judge to postpone his decision until Wednesday, in order to give the state time to look up and submit decisions bearing on the point in issue. The court refused to do this. Judge Roan added, however, that he holds himself in readiness to reverse himself if he finds that he is ruled wrong. I have no pride about that matter, said the judge. I wouldn't hesitate to reverse myself if I found I was wrong. The jury was then returned to the courtroom, and the cross-questioning of Conley was resumed by Attorney Rosser.